All right, the first three chapters of Thessalonians really don't have a lot of doctrine in it. They're very practical. And what I find interesting about this chapter, as we'll get into it, is that the Holy Spirit allows Paul's emotions to come out. Emotions of fear, emotions of concern, emotions of joy and glee and happiness, all based on how the people he preaches to responds to the message. And so it shows that preaching is very different from other occupations. When you go to work with steel or brick or mortar, once you put it there, what happens?
It's there.
It pretty well stays what you do with it. How about people?
No.
People do what they're going to do. You can put them exactly where they need to be, and then circumstances can arise, and you come back, and what's happened?
Change.
Okay, they've changed. Now, the question is, since it's really not the responsibility of the preacher to make it happen, what emotions? Should he remain aloof, or should he get involved? Now, the easiest thing to do when you're working with people is you give them the information, and they can take it or leave it. And if they take it, great. If they don't, oh well. But what we're going to see here is that the Apostle Paul is very different. And what I'd like to remind us of is how many times in the New Testament does Paul say, be imitators of me, or I'm your example, or I'm your pattern, or the things that you've seen and heard and been taught by me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. So when we look at Paul's emotions here, I think they become a template for us, and I think that we really need to look within ourselves, because where he's taking us to is agape love. Now, what's the difference between divine love and agape, or excuse me, divine love and human love? I mean, just sum it up in a couple of words. What's the difference?
Seeking the needs of others, I guess, or thinking of others.
Okay. Putting the needs of others, would you say above your own or equal to your own?
Above.
Above your own. And if they're having a problem, what's your first response? What can I do? And again, the emotions here are very fascinating. So we're going to pick up in verse 4 because we kind of covered verses 1 through 3 last week. But let's just remind ourselves of what he's doing here. He's giving them an historical summary of what happened when he came to Thessalonica, and what happened after. Now, what happened before is already in the first two chapters. What happened after starts in chapter 3, verse 1. I mean, it's sprinkled through, but starting in chapter 3, verse 1, Paul is in Athens alone, but when they dropped him off, what did they send back to? What message did he send back to Thessalonica? Okay. Send Silas and Timothy right away. Paul didn't like working alone. Is it kind of tough to go into foreign fields all by yourself and preach the gospel? Jesus sent them out two by two. So he asked for them to come. Timothy comes, and as soon as he gets there, Paul says, we thought it good to be left alone in Athens. So whose needs did he put first? Whose needs did he put second? Better for me to be alone than for me to be concerned about what's going to happen. So verse 2, I sent Timothy, our brother, and I wanted him to establish you and encourage you so that no one should be shaken by these afflictions. All right, now we pick up in verse 4. For in fact, we told you before when we were with you that we would suffer tribulation. Now, it's interesting because for years, and you probably heard the same thing, we hear people pray, we thank you, Father, that we can worship you without what? Fear of
molestation,
which is probably a platitude, more probably to the point. We thank you that we can worship you without persecution, without tribulation, without trials. And so when we preach the gospel to people, do we make an emphasis that there's going to be persecutions when you become a Christian? Do we emphasize that in our initial preaching? See, I never have, but what is Paul saying here? See, Paul said, I do. Now, this is part of the in-season and out-of-season. In other words, when you know there's going to be persecution, like for Prince, should Prince be preaching to people that if you become a Christian, there's going to be trials and tribulations? Absolutely, because there will be and there have been, and if they didn't know it was coming, it would blindside them. So Paul, and when did Paul, remember he became a Christian in Antioch, and how long was it before he got his first persecution? While he was still in Antioch. Then he goes back to Jerusalem thinking that he's the one guy who can help these people see the truth, and what do they decide to do within 15 days? They've already got a plot to kill him. Then on the first missionary journey, starting in Antioch and then going on to Iconium and Lystra and Derbe, he is persecuted, he is stoned, and left for dead. And so, was there a lot of persecution in the first century, even early on? Now, it's interesting because in the first, 20 or 30 years, who was the primary, where was the primary source of persecution?
Jews.
Comes from the Jews. After the Jews are gone, who becomes the main source of persecution? Well, then Rome does. All right, so, but either way, and in the first century, I mean, a lot of people lost their lives, a lot of people lost their liberty. Hebrews chapter 10, it talks about the spoiling of your possessions and the loss of your liberty. And so Paul says, I made sure that you knew you would suffer persecution and tribulation. And just as it happened, and you know. Now, once again, how quickly did it happen in Thessalonica? See, at least in Philippi, he got to stay there a long time before he cast out that woman, or excuse me, that demon out of that woman, and persecution started. How about in Thessalonica? Just within a few weeks. Matter of fact, he preaches in the synagogue for a few weeks. Then he goes out, and all the city, all the Gentiles come, and what does that fill the Jews with?
Envy.
Is that an appropriate response for people wanting to hear God's word? Envy?
No.
But that's what they did. All right, so, and then he, in verse 5, when I could no longer endure it. Now, how many of us, let's just say with Paul. Paul, we heard last week, Paul's in the hospital last Wednesday night. Now, how many of us could hardly endure that? How many of us were concerned about him? How many of us actually prayed for him? Paul is saying here, from the time I've left Thessalonica until now, I have been under extreme duress. I have been under extreme concern. And even though I'm in Athens by myself, when Timothy comes, I could not endure not knowing what was going on with you and not sending someone to help you out. And so for this reason, when I could no longer endure it. Now, the reason I use Paul, and because we don't have the kind of situation, but how many of us, when we heard about that woman in India, who they tore her house down, they threw her out of the village, and she decided it's not worth being a Christian, and she fell away. Have any of us really felt any concern for that? Could we say that it's such an agony that it's almost hard to endure? And yet, here's Paul, a gospel preacher, making it clear that he had great concern for his brethren. And would you call that agape love?
Yes.
When Stephen was being stoned, what was Jesus doing? Was he sitting at the right hand of God exalted? He was standing. Why was he standing? Well, clearly he was concerned. He was concerned. And when later, he tells Saul, why are you persecuting me? He takes it personal. And so Paul here, and again, we're going to see this more and more fully as we get into the section, that his emotions are powerful and they are overwhelming to him. And you would think to yourself, how exhausting would that be? Because it isn't just Philippi. I'm sorry, it isn't just Thessalonica. It's Philippi. It's going back Galatia. In the churches of Galatia, the different churches. How does he put it in 2 Corinthians when he talks about in perils of rivers and perils of robbers and perils among false brethren? And then what does he say about all the churches?
Well, that's his voice's concern.
Okay, anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak? And so I couldn't endure it. Now, he's trying to help these people understand, I didn't leave you. I'm not a false teacher. I didn't come in to get yours. I wanted you. As he told the Corinthians, I would gladly spend and be spent for your souls. So here he says, I sent to know your faith, lest by some means the tempter had tempted you. So now we bring Satan into this. Now, persecution, does persecution come because Satan puts things into people's minds so they have to persecute Christians? Or does it come because the darkness hates the light? So it comes not directly from the tempter, but can the tempter use these events to bring about the fall of Christians? And that's the concern that Paul has, that the tempter, and so again, he's bringing Satan into this mix. And he's going to bring Jesus in. He's going to bring God in. And he's going to be showing these people that we are in the midst of a great conflict between God and his plans and the devil and his desire to thwart those plans. And then he makes an interesting point, which he makes over and over again. I wanted to spend a little bit of time on that. Lest our labor might be in vain. Now, this goes back to what we talked about earlier. If I build a house and I put the 2x4s in right and I put the sheetrock on right and I get ready to move in and everything looks good, is that going to change on me? Is the house going to say, well, I'm tired of being upright, I'm going to lean today? But what about people? You could put the same effort into people. Matter of fact, you could put the same effort into 10 people, and what kind of results are you going to get? You're going to get different results. Now, Paul talks about labor being in vain. Now, I know Paul is not talking about his own personal salvation because he made it very clear in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, I plant, Apollos waters, who gives the increase? God gives the increase. So then, he that plants and he that waters are what?
Nothing.
But God who gives the increase. And yet, look at how many times at the bottom of page 1, how many times Paul talks about being in vain. When he writes to Galatians, he says about the going to Jerusalem for the conference, he said, we started with just the apostles and the elders because we were concerned that if this thing got out of hand and it split the church, then all the efforts that had been put forth would be in vain. Then he tells the Galatians, have you suffered so many things in vain? If indeed it was vain. And then in Galatians 4, lest I labor for you in vain. And then you can go down through and see the points. Look at this passage, though, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. We read the first verse, but now look at the second one. It continues on in verse 13. He says, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. Now he's talking about people. Talking about people. And now verse 14, if anyone's work which he has built endures, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss because it'll be in vain. But what about him? He'll still be saved. So the vain that he's talking about is not personal. It's not what I might lose or gain. What's his concern?
People.
For them. His work is to supplement, well, how did he put it in Philippians? I am willing to suffer in my own body to make up or to complete the suffering of Christ. Now, how can Paul complete the suffering of Christ? Wasn't it perfect? So why does he say that? Because Jesus' death will be meaningless if the individuals we preach to do not do what? They've got to remain faithful. And Paul says, I'll do whatever I can. Whatever I have to suffer in my own flesh to complete the goal of what Christ died for them for, I'm going to willingly do it. So he's emphasizing here, once again, the intense feelings that he has toward what he's hoping for these people. He wants them to be saved. He wants them to get to heaven. All right, let's go ahead and turn on to the next page. Now, verse 6 fits perfectly into Acts 18. If you look at verse 5 there, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia. So he's talking about that event when Timothy came just now. So he sent him back from Ephesus. Now he's come back, and now he's writing this letter. This is the first letter that he writes from Corinth. And so he says, he brought back good news of your faith and love, that you always have good remembrance of us, greatly desiring to see us as we also to see you. Now, this is just summarizing what he said through the first part of the book. And you can look at a couple of those verses there. But I think, again, the interesting point is this greatly desiring to see us as we also to see you. So this isn't Paul looking at his responsibilities and obligations and checking them off and saying, well, I have a responsibility to come back to you. No, what term does he use? Greatly desire. Now, if you look at the definition right in the middle of the page, well, at least on my page, I'm not sure where it is on yours, to long for something with the implication of recognizing a lack, deeply desire, long for greatly. Now, what was the lack? What was it that the Thessalonians lacked that they wanted Paul to come back to do? Would you like to be a member of the church where Paul is a preacher? Wouldn't that have been inspiring? Wouldn't that have been amazing? I would love to spend time with that man. I would love to have that man looking over and preaching sermons and working. And that's how the Thessalonians felt. How about Paul? How does he feel? I'm already busy in Corinth and I've got all these other responsibilities. How does he feel about Thessalonica? He feels the same way they do. I want to come back. I have something to give. You have something you need. You need me and you are very desirous of that. I need you because I want to help you. So look at verse 7 now. Therefore, brethren, in all our affliction and distress, we were comforted concerning you by your faith. How many of us, when somebody falls away, we just say, well, we did our best and they brought it on their own head and bye-bye and we never really think too much about them again. But here's Paul. Paul has a very different attitude. And again, I want to emphasize this only because it's a template for us to lay ourselves on and to kind of judge ourselves. Because if we are just doing things to check boxes off, where's the agape love? See, there won't be any agape love. And without love, we're in trouble. So in verse 7, our afflictions and distresses. Now, not all of Paul's afflictions and distresses were coming from Thessalonica, but enough of it was that when Timothy came with the news that they were faithful, he says, we were comforted. We were soothed and calmed, and we felt a sense of release. And then look at verse 8. For now we live. What does that mean about before he got this news? What was he doing? Was he dying? Let me give you an illustration. You get a phone call that your child has just been in a terrible accident and we don't know if he's going to live or die. Now, until you get that next phone call, what has just happened to life? I mean, it's you're alive, but you're not alive. Your focus is completely on that event. And Paul was so borne down by his concern for the Thessalonians that when he got the good news, now, would this be an exaggeration? Is Paul just saying, well, oh boy, now we're alive, now we live. But he doesn't really feel that way? No, this is inspiration. This is how he felt. He had this deep concern. All right, let's go ahead and jump to the next page. Okay, so now we live if. Okay, if you stand fast in the Lord. So if you waver, I feel distress. I feel anguish. I feel sorrow. That's how I feel sometimes when Prince is struggling or when the brethren in Malawi are struggling. If they're wavering, you feel a sense of distress. I need to get over there. I need to help. If they become fixed, then you feel a sense of joy, a sense of peace, a sense of realization that these people are growing and developing on their own. And so Paul wants these brethren to understand this, that my peace is based on, in part, how you live. Now, what does it say? You remember when Esau married two women from Canaan? What does it say about Jacob and Rebekah? Is it Rebekah? Yeah, Jacob and Rebekah. No, not Jacob, Isaac and Rebekah. They were a grief of mind to them. Anybody ever felt that? When your child gets involved with an evil companion and you're just really afraid that they might bring them down, are they a grief of mind? And so Paul here is talking about his grief of mind as his brethren. How did he put it with the Galatians? I'm in travail until Christ be formed in you. I've got this concern until I can see that this is actually coming together for you. And then in verse 9, for what thanks can we render to God for you for all the joy with which we rejoice for your sake before the Lord? Now, that is powerful emotion. His concern was turned to joy. And he says, I have so much joy, I don't even know how to thank God for it. What thanks can we render to God for you for all the joy with which we rejoice for your sake before the Lord? Now, we might feel this joy if something really good happens to us, but do we feel this joy when somebody we've been working with in this congregation who looked like they were circling the drain, it looked like they might fall away, and then suddenly they got their feet under them and they started pulling and they started doing? And here's Paul with a group of people. How long did he know these people, these Thessalonians? A couple months. Can you develop personal relationships in a couple of months? Well, yes and no. But he's so relieved for all the joy with which we rejoice for your sake before our God. And so when we think about the lost, there ought to be some emotion, some care, some concern, some desire. When we think about the brethren who are struggling, then the same thing. And a lot of times, these announcements that are made from the from up here before services, there's things that should concern us, things that should lead us to care, concern, anxiety, tribulation, sorrow, troubles. And when that goes away, a sense of relief, a sense of joy, and a need to thank God. So what thanks can we give for all the prayers that he has answered? All right, any thoughts on any of this up to this point? Rob?
Some might be critical of Paul and say, well, you know, he's worrying unnecessarily. He should have faith in God, that God's going to take care of it. But based on what you're saying, yes, Paul has faith in God. But then, as you brought out at the beginning, these are people, and they're not always, you know, sometimes they're not stable, or the situation they're in isn't stable. We can't believe people in India saying, well, they ought to get out of that and know better. No, they can't do that. If they're going to be a Christian, this is what they're faced with.
Right.
And the people in the first century, as you pointed out, they faced so much more than we'd ever even begin to know. But we appreciate the example we should have with things that do happen today.
And isn't that the basic meaning of fellowship? Fellowship means you let God do his part, but what do you have?
Your part.
We have our part. How does Paul feel about his part? He's intense. Even though, if you think about it, is God 99.9% and us 0.01%? I mean, in the overall scheme of things, God did it all, and God is going to work out and help us. However, there are some things we can do along the way. And that's why, for example, in 1 Corinthians 8 through 10 or in Romans 14, what does Paul say about our care and concern for those brothers who are weaker than us or those brothers who are stronger than us? And are we willing to forego our liberties, or are we willing to pull back on our judgment and let them make their decision so we don't become a what to them? Stumbling block. So we don't cause them to stumble. How did Jesus put it? If you cause one of these little ones to stumble, better to get a millstone out and tie it around your neck. All right, Virgil, I think I saw your hand.
One of the things that rings through with all of this is, yes, Paul is a spokesman here in that one sense of the word, but look at all of the references, we. He's bringing others in, and their feelings has obviously been expressed to him also. He's not just a one-man stand, Paul is. He looks to others and also how they feel and things like that.
Sure.
And sometimes we have a tendency just to think and say, well, you know, this is it. Nobody's with me. Oh, there's probably more with you if you're on the right side.
Right.
And there may even be more with you if you're on the wrong side. So you,
yeah.
So
yeah.
You have to discern that. But I think it's important that within any congregation or any group that we need to take and recognize that there are others that's involved. I think some of the best works that we can do with these people in Africa, in India, is to let them know that they are not alone. They're not alone. And we are not alone in our message to you.
Right.
That we're a small congregation, but we're one in the thought that we're going to do whatever is required scripturally to help you.
Right. Good point. And of course, Paul starts the letter with Paul, Silas, and Timothy.
Yeah.
So he's more than happy to share the appreciation and the workload with those two individuals. All right. Okay, so let's drop down to verse 10. Night and day praying exceedingly. You know, one of the interesting changes I think that occurs as we mature as Christians is that our prayers begin to shift. I think when we're young, our prayers are 95% about us. You know, Lord, I need this, and I need this, and I need this. As we grow as a Christian, what starts to happen? We start shifting away. And that's why, like in Ephesians chapter 6, when Paul says, put on the whole armor of God, and then he starts listing them. And then at the very end of that, he says, and praying always with all prayer and supplication for all the saints. So that's a command. That's a responsibility we have to pray for all the saints. And so if you haven't done it before, get out your directory and say a prayer for each individual in directory. You say, well, I don't know some of them. Well, what does that mean? If you say, I don't know this. Or if you're praying, Father, please help them to grow, what does that automatically mean you should be doing from here on out? See, you have to help them grow. And as I said, that's where we're heading with this idea of agape love, which we'll get to in just a moment. Anybody else? Okay. All right. So what thanks can we render in verse 9? And then night and day praying exceedingly. In other words, this is not just a Father, please do this, this, and this. This is importunity. This is emotion. Again, it's like when you get that phone call and your child's in the hospital or your parent's in the hospital and you don't know the outcome and they're under surgery. And are you just praying, oh, in the morning, I hope you help my dad today or hope you help my son today, and then that's it for the day? See, we don't do that because we are deeply concerned. And I think that's why God uses the term brotherly kindness, because what are we supposed to do with our family when we become a Christian? Broaden it out to include other people. All right, so, but Paul has a specific point. Number one is to see their face, but that's the minor element. The second is to perfect what is lacking. And I've got a sermon I preach from time to time called Mending Our Nets, because that's what this word means, to mend and put back into the proper condition. Now, God gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, and teachers to perfect the saints. Same word as here, to perfect the saints. And Paul says, I want to come so I can perfect what is lacking. Now, if you look at the definition here toward the bottom of the page, it has the idea of fitting out a ship. So you get done with your voyage, you're getting ready to go out on another voyage, you need to check the sails, you need to check the ropes, you need to check the tackle, you need to check that there's food. In other words, when you leave, you get to go back and say, oops, once you're out in the middle of the ocean. See, it's all, you got to give thought to it. And so that's a word Paul picks, is that Christians need to be fitted out just like a ship for the voyage. And so if you look at the definitions, to put into appropriate condition, to set up, to equip, to arrange, to mend. All right? Any of us need mending? We have a song in our songbook about that, mended and whole. We are mended and whole. I don't know that any of us are there yet. I know I'm not. I am mending and continually work, but there's still a lot that's torn, a lot that needs to be put back together. All right, verse 11. Some people look at this as a prayer. Now may our God and Father himself and our Lord Jesus Christ direct our way to you. I think what Paul is doing here is he is giving us a summary of what all of his prayers were hoping for. And so all the prayers, when he says in verse 10, night and day praying exceedingly that God will do these things for us. And then now he kind of summarizes what he's been asking God to do and what he expects that God will do, and that is direct our way to you. Now, when did Paul get back to Thessalonica? He's in Corinth. He's going to be there for a year and a half. Then where does he go? Back to Jerusalem. Remember, he shaves his head, goes to, because he's going to go and there's a fast. Then he goes back through all the churches that he'd already established, including Galatia and Phrygia. Then he comes to Ephesus, and how long is he there? Probably close to two years and maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months. So a year and a half and two and a half is four, and then I don't know how long it took him to go all the way back to Jerusalem and then all the way back around. Let's say another year. So now we're at 5 years. And then he finally gets back to Macedonia. When he can't find Titus, he goes to Macedonia. And where's Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea? They're all in Macedonia. So it's about 5 years. So even though he's praying exceedingly, when does God finally open that door for him? So it takes a while. It takes a while for Paul to get there, but he's still praying that he can see their face and perfect what is lacking in order to bring about the Lord making or directing his way. So he wanted to come back, and it was his heart's desire and supplication. He was intensely involved in it, and now as he summarizes everything, he's hoping that God and Father himself and our Lord Jesus Christ, with the power they have, will direct our way towards you. Now, are we talking providence here? Well, definitely providence. Are we talking direct intervention? Well, maybe. When you ask God to heal someone, are you talking providence or direct intervention? Well, providence, but could he directly intervene? Sure. When Elijah prayed for rain, was he looking for providence or direct intervention? See, he was looking for direct intervention. But did God just send rain, or did he allow it to come up like it normally does? And that's what providence is God getting involved in bringing something about. And we never know. We never know if a meeting we have with someone is just time and chance, or if it's providence, or if God has directly gotten involved in order to bring it about, because he sees a need and we need to take advantage of that need. So Paul here is asking for God to intervene providentially, directly, through the power of prayer, whatever way he wants. I mean, do I care when I ask God to do something? Do I care how he does it? I just want him, when somebody's sick and I say, Father, please heal them, I don't care if he does it through medicine or through a doctor or somehow he got involved in it directly. We'll never know until the judgment day, but can he do that? Can I pray for him to do something and he gets involved directly? Yeah, he can do that. All right. Verse 12. And may the Lord make you increase and abound in love toward one another and to all. Now, before we comment on this, I've got two verses. Actually, I've got one verse I want to read, and that's about a third of the way down, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and length and depth and heights, to know the love of Christ which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Now, if you break that verse down, that is a huge verse. It is setting forth the fact that can we comprehend this? It's incomprehensible. It passes knowledge. To know the love of Christ which passes knowledge. Well, what is it about the love of Christ? It's wide. It's long. It's deep. It's high. To know the width, length, depth, and height, to know the love of Christ. In order to do that, Christ has to dwell in your hearts through faith so that you can become rooted and grounded in love. Now, that's a agricultural term, rooted. Grounded is a architectural term. When you're going to put up a building, what do you have to have before you get started? It's got to be grounded. If it doesn't have a good foundation, it's going to fall. How about a tree? Does it need to be rooted? Yeah, especially during the summer. If the tree's not rooted enough, what'll happen in the summer? It'll wither. All right. So let's look at this paragraph just above that, right under verse 12. I just want to read part of the paragraph. It starts with, this is a common theme in all Paul's letter. Love is the greatest thing, greater than faith and hope. The gospel has brought agape love from heaven and restored it to the earth. God is love. Love is greater than faith and hope. It is the bond of perfection. And the entire law hangs and depends from it. Pure agape love does not exist on this earth. It exists in heaven, in the heart of God, and the gospel restores it. But it is a long process of putting away selfishness and learning to live, to serve, and help others. And that's why reading this chapter, reading this section, where Paul talks about his emotions, with his concern, his care, his efforts, his toil, we're getting a picture of agape love. We're getting an understanding of setting aside. I mean, let's face it, was Jesus enjoying his life in heaven before? Let me rephrase that. Was the Word enjoying his life in heaven before he left heaven to become a man and die on the cross for us? Why did he come? Love. Greater love has no man than this. Lay down his life for his friends, and you are my friends if you keep God's commandments. So Jesus came to show us agape love. Remember Romans chapter 5? God demonstrates his own love to us in that while we were still enemies and sinners, what did God do? He sent his son to die for us. And there's another verse I want to look at, and that's at the very bottom of page 4. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you and do good to those who hate you and pray for those who despitefully use and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now, this perfection is dealing with agape love, dealing with the ability that we have to shift our priorities away from ourselves, my wants, my needs, my family, my job, my future, my children, my, and we just keep going. And at some point in a Christian life, agape love is going to lead to yours, your children, your life, your problems, your needs, you. And we shift away. And as you look at Jesus' life on earth, how much was me? How much was Jesus focused on himself? Very little. He was focused on us. At the foot washing, when he set aside even his dignity, even his position as one who had come from God, was going back to God, he was just about to take the throne, just about to become King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And it says, he loved his own to the end, and he took a towel, and he went and washed the disciples' feet. And when he got done, what did he say? This is your example. If I did it, are you too good to do it? You call me teacher and Lord, and so I am. But if you want to be perfect as your Father is perfect, you're going to have to learn how to wash each other's feet. You're going to have to learn how to care about other people. It isn't just a job. It isn't just a checklist. It isn't just, okay, I heard this week that somebody needs food and somebody needs me to pray for them. And so it's just another task. But agape love changes that. And as I said, as you go through this chapter and you see Paul's emotions coming out so strongly, and this isn't the only place that you see this, but it's an interesting mirror to put up in front of ourselves to see just how far we are coming in our own agape love and how much like Paul we actually are. All right, we're going to stop there. Anybody have any other thoughts or questions? Okay, thanks everybody. We'll pick up then, finish up chapter 3 next week.